This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
It's December 19th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Humanism is a worldview based on reason and compassion.
Way to change it up, Duncan.
You know, I'm sort of honing this definition. I might try to sneak in creativity one of these times, but listeners, you'll have to call in and let me know how I'm doing with my definition of humanism.
Sounds good. So, Duncan, end of December, it's that time of year.
Don't remind me, I haven't even gone shopping yet.
What do you do as a non-religious, as a secular guy to celebrate?
I celebrate Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. You remember what Rabbi Sherwin Wine said, the founder of humanistic Judaism? He was on our show before, and he was talking about, look, you know, Jewish humanists celebrate Hanukkah. Humanists from a Christian background celebrate Christmas. They just focus on the family, but these are like cultural traditions, right?
Right.
So although there is a group, they start in New Jersey that started a celebration called Human Light.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to emphasize, you know, the human reason and compassion during almost the same time as Christmas. So,
do you think that Salman Rushdie is currently celebrating Human Light with those folks? He was offered.
He was offered, but he wanted to celebrate Atheismus, if I recall.
That's
so
right.
You can't get these people to agree, can you? What's on the show today?
Well, we've got a great listener comment that we're going to play towards the end of the show.
And if I recall, we let one of our HNN podcast listeners from Sweden turn the microphone around onto one of us.
Mm-hmm. But the main feature of our show is an interview with Dr. Richard Selzer, who is a well-known author and surgeon. Dr. Selzer was born in Troy, New York in 1928. He was educated at Union College, Albany Medical College, and Yale. Dr. Selzer is the author of several books, including Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery, Confessions of a Knife, Down from Troy, A Doctor Who Comes of Age, and Rituals of Surgery. So, Duncan, I know you're a big fan of Dr. Selzer. How did you actually find out about him?
I live in Troy, so I saw this book in the local section, Down from Troy, A Doctor Comes of Age, mm-hmm. and just became really enamored of Dr. Selzer's writing style and his view. And I've always wanted to get him on our podcast to add the medical voice to our discussion on humanism. I mean, after all, doctors and nurses are the ones who take care of humanity.
Sure. And how does it relate to humanism and to our show and to religion?
Well, in addition to the simple fact of medical practitioners taking care of humanity, I mean, that is humanism in itself. But as far as the religious concepts go, this is a passage that I spotted in Dr. Selzer's story, Liver, from his book, Mortal Lessons. And he says, medicine, as is well known, is an offshoot of religion. The predecessor of the physician as healer was the priest as exorciser. It is a quite manageable leap for me from demons to germs as the source of disease. It is equally easy to slide from incantation to prescription.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, there is sort of this symbolic relationship. Doctors, are authority figures just as priests are. We look to doctors for comfort that they know what's actually going on.
And, of course, a lot of hospitals mm-hmm. are run by religions.
And there are a lot of conflicts between medical advances and faith. I also think that anyone practicing in science, the more scientific knowledge you gain, the more difficult it becomes for some to have faith in the supernatural.
Duncan, you addressed all these issues in your interview with Dr. Selzer last month, so why don't we go ahead and play that now?
Dr. Richard Selzer, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today.
It's my pleasure.
We're here in the Beinecke Library of Rare Books at Yale University, where you studied in the surgical training program, and you also taught as a professor in the Yale School of Medicine. I think that the best way to begin this interview would be to have you read a passage from your book that I've selected. This is chapter 7 from your book,
down from Troy.
If I fail to describe Father, his hairless white arms and legs, toothbrush mustache, aluminum hair, hands small and powerful, skin more gray than pink, it is because none of his features did him justice. I should have had to mention wings in order to do that. Father's professed atheism, far from setting an example, had the opposite effect. From age 10, I developed an attraction toward the bells, incense, and statuary of St. Peter's Church. Besides, the New Testament seemed so much more civilized and human than the old, the gentle Christ more appealing than testy, vengeful Jehovah. I did not see myself or any of my friends among the cast of characters of the Old Testament. Every chance I got, I sneaked into St. Peter's, where I followed the Stations of the Cross with perfervid relish. It had to be done behind Grandpa's back, a trick made easier by the presence of his bilateral cataracts. Furtiveness was a good part of the pleasure. It gave the flavor of vice to church-going. 2 years later, I renounced religion for good and settled into exclusion from faith, the way one is blackballed from membership in a club that one had never wanted to join. As for the hereafter, oblivion was preferable to hell. Still, my atheism is far from devout, but a rather lazy, half-hearted form of the creed, tinged with what the French call la nostalgie de la croyance. It is that nostalgia for faith that has led me into any number of monasteries and churches to seek out the company of the pious. Nor am I so certain of the inefficacy of prayer, but am beginning to suspect that gazing, listening, and contemplating may influence the material universe. As casual as was Father's attitude toward prostitution, just so lightly did he treat the subject of religion. One faith was no better than any other, and personally, he enjoyed a carefree atheism. He loved poking fun at the hereafter, calling it the great perhaps. "It is said that you don't have to pee in heaven," he said. "If that's true, the dead are luckier than we are." Our early theological discussions were terse. Was Adam a baby when he was born? Who changed his diaper? Yes, and God. Jesus changed Adam's diaper? Go ask your mother. What's a soul, I wanted to know. No such thing, he replied. Well, supposing there were, what would it be? Oh, a little bag of air, I suppose. Like a breeze or a draft or a bit of a gale, only held inside of a bubble. Some of them smell pretty bad from all the wickedness. Others, like yours, smell sweet as flowers. I put it to Mother. What about God? Unlike your father, I do believe in him, she said vaguely, and preferred to let it go at that. When I related this to Father, he snickered. Your mother feels the same way about God as she does about Ethiopia. She's reasonably certain he's there. But every so often, I caught her praying, offering explanations for her behavior, begging for advice and intercession, all the while excluding him from knowledge of her misdeeds, as though his ears were too innocent and pure for such revelations. For an atheist, Father seemed to know a good deal about matters of religion. Nor did he hesitate to pass this lore on to us. His favorite book was Fox's Book of Martyrs. He took gruesome delight in reading aloud the details of the torture suffered by the holy. On the subject of martyrdom, which he did not think at all stupid, he allowed that his idea of a martyr was a certain John Ziska. Just before he was to be flayed during the Protestant Reformation, Ziska bequeathed his skin to the church to be made into a drum. Whenever it would be banged, the faithful would be called to worship. That sort of thing, Father always told with a hint of derision. And so it was with no little surprise that one day I watched him hammer a nail in the waiting room wall and then hang a crucifix on it. "But we're not Catholic," I reminded him. "That's right, we're not. But the people who sit in this room are. It will be easier for them to offer up the waiting if they see him hanging around too." Years later, there was to come the night of my own religious imposture. I was in the midst of surgical training at Yale. An elderly man lay critically ill from complications of the operation I had performed days before. His blood pressure had fallen, his pulse and temperature risen. He was well aware of my vigorous efforts to restore him, and I think of the despair I could not conceal. "Doctor," he said, "I'm not going to make it." When I began to remonstrate, he lifted a dismissive hand. "I want to see the priest now," he told me. I left to place the call. 20 minutes later, the priest had not come, and with the man's condition deteriorating, I summoned the priest again. After the third call, it became apparent that he would not arrive in time. Once more, the man in the bed called weakly for the priest. It was his only desire, and mine as well. Turning off the light, I stepped from the room into the corridor, re-entered and lowered my voice an octave. "It is Father Cavanaugh, my son. Do you want to make your confession?" "Thank you, Father. Forgive me, for I have sinned." There followed a breathless whisper, scarcely formed into words. I waited for it to stop. "I forgive you, my son. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen." Moments later, the man was dead. All at once, the light was flicked on. A nurse, bearing a syringe and a tourniquet, paused, looked from me to the contents of the bed, then back to me. "What did you just do?" she said in a voice of granite. But unlike Father with his crucifix, I could not say what or why. It seems to me now that despite his oft-announced disbelief, Father was not an atheist at all. For him, as for me, always, the gods have been Greek, Apollo, Aphrodite, Dionysus, and the rest. Neither Jehovah nor the Christian God has supplanted them. These days, when the daily manipulation of words upon a page has become a settled, sedentary business, I sometimes gaze out the window of my study and murmur a prayer of thanks or make a propitiatory offering to the inhabitants of Parnassus. Besides, in Father, the priest and the sensualist existed side by side. His performance of the simplest acts, lighting a fire in the grate, tamping down a cigarette, lathering on shaving cream, trimming his spruce little mustache, partook of these two elements. They were present in his practice of medicine, the way his fingers questioned a pulse. The bodies of his patients were both the pasture upon which his senses grazed and his pasturage. Once in a house call, he needed me to hold a man's legs still while he debrided an infected gash. I could not hide my revulsion at the stench, the ugliness of the rotting flesh. He looked up to see the disgust on my face and nodded to himself as though his worst fears had been confirmed. "A wound is like a lamp," he said. "If all the lights in the house were turned out, you could dress a wound by the light it gives off. One day, you will learn to love wounds," he said on the way home, and tumors and festering sores. To him, they were among the most beautiful things in the world. I did not then understand how a festering sore could be thought beautiful. I do now. For the vivid colors, odor, and shape of such a wound appeal to the sensual mind, and each carries within it the glorious possibility of being healed. It offers to the doctor the glorious privilege of healing it. Years later, I would try to write about the beauty of the wound, blood spreading across a pillow, a vase of dead flowers in a sick room, an amputated leg, rendering the events of the body and illness in the keenest language I could find. If invited to choose one of three chests in which to locate a writer's treasure, I would be like Bassanio in The Merchant of Venice, who picked neither the gold nor the silver casket, but the one made of lead, which rather threatenst than dost promise aught. It is what comes of having discovered beauty in the most unlikely places. The writer attempts to bridge the wound of childhood with words, knowing all the while that should the wound heal, he would no longer be a writer. Unlike the wound of the body, the healing of such a wound would kill a writer.
Dr. Richard Selzer, do you remember what you said to me the first time you read that passage?
No. What did I say?
You said, "That is my humanism."
Oh, it's true. It's true. It has nothing to do with the facts, but everything to do with truth. The facts are just there on the surface, but the truth lies deeper. It is the real, real that lies beneath the real. And that's what I've been after in my surgery and in my writing.
Why did you pretend to be the priest?
I wanted to send this man to the next world in serenity and peace. I wanted him to have his dying wish. And so I dissembled. I pretended to be something that I was not. Was it hypocrisy? Was it perjury? I don't think so. If it was, I would like to be forgiven for it.
Although you say you're somewhat of a lazy atheist, you've always been drawn to religious symbolism, ceremony. Do you feel that your literature would be impoverished without religious imagery?
Yes, I do. In the same way that painting and sculpture would be impoverished without the paintings of the religious paintings and religious sculptures of the Renaissance. Can you picture the world of art without representations of the crucifix and the saint and the saints and the Virgin Mary? No, you can't. They're all an essential part of art. And in my writing, faith plays a very great role. And even though I claim to not be a man of no faith at all, I think there's a lot of self-deception in that remark, because I find myself very spiritual and requiring the consolation of faith. I don't believe in a hereafter.
Can you say that again?
I do not believe in a hereafter. I don't believe there is a heaven or hell. Not that. I think that is a kind of dream, a wish fulfillment for people who do not want to die. And I don't blame them, but I don't share it. I don't have that. My faith does not include a vision of heaven or hell.
This is Margaret Downing, president of the Atheist Alliance International. and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We were just listening to an interview with Duncan and Dr. Richard Selzer. And Dr. Selzer just talked about something that several past guests who are also authors have brought up, which is this concept of using religious metaphors in their secular and even atheist literature.
Yeah, like Philip Holman on the last show.
That's right, Salman Rushdie.
Salman Rushdie before mm-hmm. that. Obviously, Dr. Selzer doesn't have the same struggle that Salman Rushdie does in seeking irreligious language that has the same power as religious language. Selzer just uses the religious words.
That's right. For example, he was saying that he wanted to help his patient move to the next life, even though he himself doesn't believe in an afterlife of any kind of sort.
Yeah, it's a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time I spoke with Dr. Selzer about that passage, he explained to me that, what was going through his mind was, I'm a doctor and I'm supposed to relieve suffering and comfort my patients, and my patient believes in the afterlife, so I'm going to give him this comfort.
How about you back up to where you said the first time I spoke to Dr. Selzer and tell the listeners what that's all about.
Okay, well, now that we've let the cat out of the bag, Jess, I did interview Dr. Selzer several months ago for our podcast and destroyed the file when I was uploading it to our computer.
And
the good doctor generously agreed to give me another interview.
That's right. Atheism came early for someone.
It did. Now let's get back to that interview.
Dr. Selzer, I'd like to ask you to read one more brief passage and then we'll continue the discussion. This is a piece titled The Surgeon as Priest, and it is from your book, Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery.
In the foyer of a great medical school, there hangs a painting of Vesalius. Lean, ascetic, possessed, the anatomist stands before a dissecting table upon which lies the naked body of a man. The flesh of the two is silvery, a concentration of moonlight, like a strange rain of virus, washes them. The cadaver has dignity and reserve. It is distanced by its death. Vesalius reaches for his dissecting knife. As he does so, he glances over his shoulder at a crucifix on the wall. His face wears an expression of guilt and melancholy and fear. He knows that there is something wrong, forbidden in what he is about to do, but he cannot help himself, for he is a fanatic. He is driven by a dark desire to see, to feel, to discover is all. His is a passion, not a romance. I understand you, Vesalius. Even now, after so many voyages within, so much exploration, I feel the same sense that one must not gaze into the body, the same irrational fear that it is an evil deed for which punishment awaits. Consider, the sight of our internal organs is denied us. To how many men is it given to look upon their own spleens, their hearts, and live? The hidden geography of the body is a Medusa's head, one glimpse of which would render blind the presumptuous eye. Still, rigid rules are broken by the smallest inadvertencies. I pause in the midst of an operation being performed under spinal anesthesia to observe the face of my patient, to speak a word or two of reassurance. I peer above the screen, separating his head from his abdomen, in which I am most deeply employed. He's not asleep, but rather stares straight upward, his attention riveted, a look of terrible discovery, of wonder upon his face. Watch him. This man is violating a taboo. I follow his gaze upward and see in the great operating lamp suspended above his belly the reflection of his viscera. There is the liver, dark and turgid above. There the loops of his bowel winding slow. There his blood runs extravagantly. It is that which he sees and studies with so much horror and fascination. Something primordial in him has been aroused, a fright, a longing. I feel it too, and quickly bend above his open body to shield it from his view. How dare he look within the ark, cover his eyes. But it is too late. He has already seen that which no man should. He has trespassed. And I am no longer a surgeon, but a hierophant who must do magic to ward off the punishment of the angry gods. I feel some hesitation to invite you to come with me into the body. It seems a reckless, defiant act. Yet there is more than dread reflected from these rosy coasts, these restless estuaries of pearl. And it is time to share it, the way the catbird shares the song, which must be a joy to him and is a living truth to those who hear it. So shall I make of my fingers words, of my scalpel a sentence, of the body of my patient a story. One enters the body in surgery as in love, as though one were in exile, returning at last to his hearth, daring uncharted darkness in order to reach home. Turn sideways, if you will, and slip with me into the cleft I have made. Do not fear the yellow meadows of fat, the red that sweats and trickles where you step. Here, give me your hand. Lower between the beefy cliffs. Now rest a bit upon the peritoneum. All at once, gleaming, the membrane parts, and you are in.
Thank you for reading that.
I have to tell you that recently I made the decision to donate my body to the anatomy department of the Yale School of Medicine to be dissected by the first-year medical students. You can see what a difficult decision it was for me to do this, having just heard me read that piece. But I decided that rather than be a dead body stuck in a hole in the ground and with a monument over it that no one would ever visit in time, I would transform my flesh and bones into knowledge and give it to the four students who will be doctors so that they can use that knowledge to heal generations of their patients. For me, it is a way of transcending death. It's a triumph over death to go on in that fashion. And so I went down to the anatomy lab and I said to the manager there what I wanted to do. And he said, well, doctor, we don't very often get walk-in donors. In fact, you're the first one. I said, well, it's a statement that I am making and I want it to be told.
That's wonderful. I wanted to ask you, in that passage, it seems very Miltonian. You know, I say, although inadvertently, John Milton wrote one of the great works of humanism by telling the story of Adam and Eve and their fall from the Garden of Eden. And I feel like your description of entering the human body, you know, becoming a surgeon, it has the imagery of the forbidden knowledge. Do you recognize it?
Yes, I do. And that is something that I had to come to grips with in my training as a surgeon and in my long years of practice of invading the human body. It was an obstacle for me to overcome, but I did. And I was glad that I did because I feel that I helped a lot of people through their illness.
In recent news, there are controversies over stem cell research and other areas of medicine and science. Where do you feel you're now drawing the line as to what is an acceptable area to go in with medical research. Where do you draw the line?
Well, I'm in favor of stem cell research. I was in favor of it even when it was the stem cells were coming from embryos.
And recently they've announced that they found a new way.
And I'm very relieved and glad because I think this opens the way for a settlement of this conflict and this controversy, and that great good will come from it.
But it seems like we've skirted the controversy because they found a loophole to appease the religious opposition to using embryonic stem cells from embryonic materials. So it seems like the controversy will arise again, I assume, inevitably.
I don't see how.
Well, I'm sorry, let me clarify. It will arise again inevitably in some other medical area.
Oh, perhaps it will. I don't know. But you aren't going to be able to stop the progress of science. It's relentless. On it will go. And I think up to a point I feel it's a good thing. I have no wish to prolong life to an absurd level. I certainly don't want to live to be 120. And I have no fear of death. Whenever it comes, it comes. And we all share that destiny. So I'm at peace with it. I would not change my lifestyle in the hope that I would prolong my life for many years. As a doctor, I strove to prolong the life of my patient.
Well,
and as a writer, I find it difficult to kill off a character in one of my stories, and I often change the plot in order to save that. And sometimes I even rewrite other people's stories to give a doomed character another chance.
In Down from Troy, you describe a man who contacted you with HIV and was interested in doctor-assisted suicide. The way the story panned out, he changed his mind in the end, but you were ready to go through with it in the book. You had many, many reservations, but you were ready to go through with it, and I want to ask you how you feel about doctor-assisted suicide.
Well, I am opposed to making people suffer agony indefinitely. It is merciful to let someone die and even help them to die rather than to stand at the bedside and watch someone writhing in pain. It goes against my nature to do that. So that faced with a patient or a situation in which someone is in agony and wants to die, I would acquiesce to it and put him out of his misery.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We're listening to an interview with Duncan Crary and Dr. Richard Selzer.
We've spoken to a lot of authors, Philip Pullman recently, Sam Harris. Many of them reject labels, these authors. They don't want to be known by one label or another. How do you feel about that?
Perfectly content with the label of humanist. That is, in fact, what I am. And I represent humanism in medicine. This is not typical of surgeons. Surgeons are people, men and women, who are more interested in having and doing rather than in feeling and perceiving. But I, on the other hand, am of the latter group, and I have been able to infuse my former work as a surgeon with the kind of humanism that I feel. And so that my work is, my humanistic essays and stories are taught in medical schools and nursing schools all over North America. And there has become a whole literary genre called literature and medicine, and I'm the granddaddy of that genre. I started it in the late 60s, and I'm one of a long line of doctor writers.
William Carlos Williams, Chekhov?
Yes, it goes all the way back to Rabelais and St. Thomas More and W. Somerset Maugham. Keats, John Keats was a kind of doctor. And then Chekhov, as you mentioned, William Carlos Williams. And then I came along. So about every 50 years, every half century, there has been a doctor writer, an artist. Now, today there are thousands of doctors who are writing, but they're not artists. They're writing position papers or contemporary material for our time, but they're not making art. And what the men that I mentioned in this long line of doctor writers and myself did and do is attempt to make art. We are making literature. We're not taking a position, really. I gather, I'm getting the idea that, that yours is a religious point of view subject. From the other people that you say you've interviewed and from me, and your emphasis on religious faith. Is that so?
Very much so, but it's people grappling with religious ideas in science, with you in medicine, in politics. A number of our listeners maybe steer more towards the staunch atheist position, but you know, humanism, it's a philosophy based on reason, but also based on compassion. And although it encompasses atheism, you know, it doesn't end there. And it's trying to be compassionate towards others' religious views, be tolerant of other religious views, but also science and rationality.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that organized religion, wonderful as it may be in many ways, has been one of the great curses of mankind, as we can see today in radical Islam and the Catholic Church itself perpetrated some of the bloodiest inquisitions and massacres of all time. I sometimes think that perhaps we, the human race, would have been better off without organized religions. I don't know. But I think then of the good that these religions do, the mercy that they show for the poor and the handicapped, some of the great hospitals of the world are staffed by nuns, and my father worked in one of those in Troy, New York. And I have myself been the colleague of nuns and priests.
It's often said that, you know, surgeons in particular are playing God in a way, or godlike.
Yes, that's right. And it's a matter of egotism and narcissism and power. The surgeon has always been a strong macho figure, as opposed to a pediatrician, for instance, or an obstetrician. And I think that I fly in the face of that, actually. And that is why when I began to write and publish my work, my fellow surgeons took a dim view of it. What's the matter with you, they said. Isn't surgery enough for you? And if I said, well, no, it isn't, they would be angry because it was enough for them. But I had another purpose in mind in writing, and that was to infuse the art of surgery with humanistic thought.
And you articulate that in Mortal Lessons in one passage where you describe, you say, why would a surgeon write? And then you discuss that you think the poet is more of a doctor than the surgeon, and the reason why you write is to become a doctor.
That is true. I have said that. I put it in that kind of phraseology, but it is exactly how I feel.
Dr. Selzer, I thought we could end this interview by having you read another brief passage from The Surgeon as Priest.
Listen to the neurosurgeon. Patty, buzz, suck, cut, he says. Then suck, cut, patty, buzz. It is as simple as a nursery rhyme. The surgeon knows the landscape of the brain, yet does not know how a thought is made. Man has grown envious of this mystery. He would master and subdue it electronically. He would construct a computer to rival or surpass the brain. He would harness Europa's bull to a plow. There are men who implant electrodes into the brain, that part where anger is kept, the rage center, they call it. They press a button, and a furious bull halts in mid-charge and lopes amiably to nuzzle his matador. Anger has turned to sweet compliance. Others sever whole tracts of brain cells with their knives to mollify the insane. Here is surgery grown violent as rape. These men cannot know the brain. They have not the heart for it. I last saw the brain in the emergency room. I wiped it from the shoulder of a young girl to make her smashed body more presentable to her father. Now I stand with him by the stretcher. We are arm in arm like brothers. All at once, there is that terrible silence of discovery. I glance at him, follow his gaze, and see that there is more brain upon her shoulder, newly slipped from the cracked skull. He bends forward a bit. He must make certain it is her brain. I watch the knowledge expand upon his face, so like hers. I, too, stare at the fragment, flung wetly, now drying beneath the bright lights of the emergency room, its cargo of thoughts evaporating from it, mingling for this little time with his, with mine, before dispersing in the air.
Dr. Richard Selzer, you are an amazing man, and it's an honor to have spoken with you today.
Thank you so much. I'm not really amazing. I'm just an ordinary person who does the best he can. There are, you know, life is, all lives are peculiar in a way. I have been denied certain things in life. Romantic love is one of them. Prosperity is another. But I have been given the pathway into my imagination and a certain way with words in order to express it. Was that a fair trade? I don't know. You have to tell me.
Well, I've benefited greatly from it, and so have many other readers and admirers. Thank you so much for talking with me, Dr. Selzer.
That was a great interview, Duncan.
Thank you.
My favorite part, though, I have to say, was when he mentioned walking into the anatomy department.
Oh, he had to donate his body. Yeah. We don't get too many live donors.
That's right.
Now, would you donate your body to science, Jess?
Well, I'm currently actually doing that, Duncan.
Oh, really?
I am. I'm donating my body to Ben & Jerry's to test the long-term effects of mass consumption of their products.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've signed mine over to Guinness.
That's right.
Guinness Corporation. But seriously, though, it's something that we should all consider, donating our bodies to science.
Right.
They got to get the cadavers from somewhere.
And it's one of the ways that humanists and atheists can sort of contribute to society, right?
It's more useful than communion wafers. No, but I mean, seriously, though, we had the atheist volunteer, Tom,
yep,
from Atheist Volunteers was talking about giving blood.
Right, the blood
and
drive.
There has been a lot of talk in the movement to try to orchestrate a massive campaign to get people to volunteer their organs and their bodies to medicine and science.
That's right.
So,
Duncan, you mentioned you were telling me about the place that you interviewed.
Oh yes, the Beinecke Library.
That's right. You said it was both. What did you say? Unusual and impressive.
Yes, simultaneously.
Yeah, talk some more about that.
Well, I mean, last show we spoke to James Howard Kunstler about architecture and urban planning, and I think he would have he would rip this building.
Have a field day.
Well, the architecture of Yale is this beautiful sort of classical revival style, Gothic architecture, and then the Beinecke Library is like a Martian cube, that landed in the middle of campus. It is made of marble, and it's kind of an ugly box on the outside, but on the inside, the sunlight shines through the marble. Very cool. And of course, the most impressive thing are some of the books that are there. But Dr. Selzer gave me a short tour of the place.
The Gutenberg Bible. It was printed in Mainz, Germany, about 1455, and is regarded as the first book printed from movable type in the Western world. And we have it right here. It's within arm's length of us right as we stand. And if you get up real close, you can see that it's in Latin. And
Duncan, you were an arm's length away from the first book ever printed with the modern day printing press.
Yeah, they don't check IDs to let you into the Beinecke Library. Yeah, no, that's the first modern book basically.
Right.
It enabled Gutenberg's press enabled the mass production of books and therefore the transmission of knowledge.
Right.
And of course, again, religion is sort of always intertwined in the mix, though.
Imagine the good he could have done with technology like podcasting.
Oh, well, here we are podcasting today. That's right. Yeah, the Gutenberg podcast, right.
And moving right along, we've got a great listener comment from last month's show.
Hi, I heard the interview with James Kunstler on the Humanist Network. While I thought it was a good interview, I thought that a great opportunity was lost to discuss the rise of megachurches as a result of suburbanization and their impact on politics, social relations, and simplification of religions. As you know, Kunstler describes the isolating, dehumanizing aspects of suburbanization. A related work, Bowling Alone by Putnam, also describes the degradation of social capital. One could argue that because suburbanization has so removed people from the cultural, educational, commercial, etc., traditional community-based religious institutions, they turn first to TV and then to the megachurches to fill their needs. These megachurches are charismatic, simplified, and are often selectively literalist, Reader's Digest versions of religions. A recent powerful development is the whole faith-based initiatives, pushed by the social neocons to transfer tax dollars to these same institutions. Not surprisingly, they are the ones who fill the holes in the social services produced by the budget cuts that the same social neocons push. The result is a suburban social landscape that is leaving people with fewer choices, and in times of need, they're being funneled into religious organizations that are frequently authoritarian, selectively literalist, unabashedly parochial, and often aggressive in their responses, in their relations with other faiths and ideologies. Oh, forgot to say, my name is Charles Sontag. I live down in Binghamton, New York, and I like the show. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Charles. You're right, Jess. That was a great listener comment. I didn't get a chance to talk to James Howard Kunstler about that topic specifically, but we did speak about government buildings and also the church. Way back when the church and the courthouse and town hall and city hall used to be beautiful, impressive buildings in the very important parts of town. And today, if you drive around the suburbs, he said they look like muffler shops. And it affects the psychology of the citizens. Why are we supposed to think government's important when, our government sticks itself in these crummy buildings? I promised I would post more excerpts from those interviews on our website, and I still haven't done it yet, but I will.
I think that you should make that your New Year's resolution, Duncan.
Yes, that and lose 30 pounds.
And you can leave a listener comment by calling our toll-free number, 877-659-1515.
Definitely leave us some comments about today's interview. Dr. Selzer, once we were speaking about the program and who our listeners are, he said he'd be very interested to hear what you all had to say. Somewhat little intimidated too. Okay, as promised, we ask a lot of questions around here, so we decided to give one of our international visitors the chance to turn the microphone on us. This is Soren Holst. He came to visit the Institute to interview Larry Jones. Soren is from Sweden. He's a physicist, and he is currently teaching at Skidmore College as a visiting professor.
And Larry Jones is the president of the Institute for Humanist Studies.
Okay, now we come to one of my central questions, which also probably is one of the most difficult. So as you mentioned, U.S. is one of the most religious countries in the developed world. And the question is, why? How come?
That is a difficult question. Okay. And I think part of the reason is that we never had a state religion. So we never had a religion that everybody could dislike. religion in the United States became very diverse, so that if you didn't like the church you were going to, you could go down the street and you'd find one more to your liking. So this diversity made religion very powerful. In Europe, most of the European countries had state religions, and people were not, well, they were either with that religion or against it. It was hard to have a religious movement when you have one religion. And in this country, we had just a plethora of religions that people could join. And I think one of the reasons that this took place was because of the Jeffersonian separation of church and state. And it's quite an irony that the wall of separation, it kept government out of churches, out of religion, and religion out of government, but it allowed religion to diversify into many different clones of itself. And so became much stronger, I think, than if it was a kind of one religion, one state religion that people had to either belong to or not.
Yeah, and your hypothesis here actually are strengthened by the Swedish case, because in Sweden we had until recently, until some years ago, a state church. And still, actually, 80% of our population are members in the state church. However, if you ask the Swedes if they are religious, if they identify themselves as religious, well, depending on exactly how you ask this question, but approximately around 30%, 20 or 30% would identify themselves as religious. But not very... this part of the population is very moderately religious compared to the case in the States, I think. For example, if you ask them if they believe in hell, less than 10% in Sweden would say that they believe in hell, whereas I think the corresponding number in the States is more than 70%.
Something up in that area, I'm not sure, 60, 70%. There are all kinds of paranormal beliefs in this country, that the people, maybe 30%, 40% believe in ghosts. And
so that we have in Sweden too, actually.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Now, does the Swedish government support religion, and is humanism included in that support?
No, but it is discussed now. So the Swedish government is supporting religious organizations, and the humanists in Sweden are arguing that there is no reason that we shouldn't get this support too, because when we ask about this, we get no clear answers. So I think it seems that it will not be long before we actually get support, I think.
And once you get support, then it's going to be difficult for you to advocate separation of government from religion, because in a sense you'll be cutting off your support if that works. And I know in the Netherlands and in parts of Europe where governments support, and Norway too, where they get a lot of support from their government, they kind of hedge on this position of separation of church and state, because if there is a separation and government does not support religion, it won't support humanism either. So they're a little they hedge on this topic.
Yeah, I agree. And in Sweden, I think what humanists would like is that the government should not support religious movements, but perhaps movements that support democratic principles. That we would like such a formulation, and then that would include many of our Christian organizations. Some of the religious organizations that are now getting support would lose their support, and so on. So we are trying to get that sort of formulation.
Okay. Well, that may work, and you can still advocate against the government and religion mix, which I think is extremely bad, because, as I said, if religion gets a hold into government, if a government becomes the least bit theistic, then it's almost impossible for it to be democratic.
You've been listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
Although our podcast only comes out once a month, be sure to read our weekly Humanist Network News e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. Next week's edition is the Year in Review.
You can read transcripts and download previous podcast episodes at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
The use of our theme song was generously donated to us by Holly Near. You can learn more about her and her music at hollynear.com.
And once again, that listener comment line was 877-659-1515. Folks, have a happy Festivus for the rest of us.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism.